This is the ACIA New Horizons podcast. Everything we discuss is for the analyst, to the analyst, and by the analyst.
Today I'm joined by two very interesting individuals who aim to locate missing people on a daily basis. Neil Smith served over 10 years as a police officer and has now spent most of the last 15 years as a full-time investigative researcher. Neil regularly speaks on the subject of open source intelligence and using the internet as an investigative tool. Dave Grimson has worked in the field of international and serious organised crime within the UK and National Crime Squad, now known as the NCA. He has gained experience in covert operations, leading successful investigation of people. As a senior investigating officer, Dave has handled high-risk missing persons cases and conducted reviews in relation to long-term missing people. Hello, both of you. How are we?
Fine, thank you. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. How is lockdown treating both?
Well, it's a challenge, as it is for many people around the country. Thankfully, personally unaffected health-wise, family-wise. But certainly one of the positives, if there are any positives to come out of the pandemic and the current situation, is originally when we were setting up Locate, it was the idea that we were going to actually physically attend meetings with our volunteers. So it would have been driving to a far off part of the country, meeting people, and then driving back again. Because of the restrictions, everything has moved online and everyone has had to get used to sort of Zoom or team meetings. And it means that we could have three or four meetings a day without driving anywhere. And it's probably progressed our organisation to where we would have been in a year or two. Our volunteers, so it would have been driving to a far off part of the country, meeting people, and then driving back again. Because of the restrictions, everything has moved online and everyone has had to get used to sort of Zoom or team meetings. And it means that we could have three or four meetings a day without driving anywhere. And it's probably progressed our organisation to where we would have been in a year or two. But we've got there so much quicker because we can just interact with people and have those virtual meetings, which just, you know, anyone who thinks back 14 months, you know, we just wouldn't have thought of holding these meetings. Yeah. Even if corporately you would have held a meeting like this, dealing with law enforcement, you wouldn't have got, you know, sort of senior officers online happy to discuss things over a sort of a commercial video program. Mm. And we actually had meetings with senior officers penciled in that had to be cancelled. And so this has sort of moved us forward. But that is one of the only good things that have come out of the last year.
I think it's interesting you mentioned that, because, you know, it's a good thing that this is sort of encouraging communication across different organisations, because sometimes there is a lack of that. So, like you said, this is one of the only probably positives this has given us, you know, this past year. But it's good. It's good that your organisation is progressing forward. Dave, how are you finding it?
Yeah, no, as Neil said, it was a challenge, like so many other people, when pandemic first started and things started to close down. But we wouldn't have thought that almost 8 months after the pandemic started that would lead to, for example, a virtual cold case review from students in Germany, Australia and the UK working together virtually to review a cold case of an attempted murder of a 10-year-old and a 70-year-old that had gone missing on behalf of the German public prosecutor. We wouldn't have dreamed that we would be bringing teams together to do that sort of review work. And the other thing that I've learned is Australia has so many time zones. Who'd have known?
Yes.
Just trying to manage the time zones was a challenge in itself, but all of it could be overcome. You just start the meetings at 7 o'clock in the morning. It's absolutely fine.
Yes. You've so before I actually asked your question, what you just mentioned about cold casing, because that sounds quite interesting, especially when you said virtual, because I could, in my head, I'm thinking of quite a lot of sort of challenges and also ethical considerations you might have to think about whilst doing that. Tell us about Locate International. What is this organisation about?
So Locate really came about from, you know, you just get those cases that stay with you. And I remember a case from 1996 when I was working as a detective on the major crime team in the UK. And a young lady simply came out of a nightclub and disappeared. And it was another 13 years before the body was found. The case remains unsolved. But when I retired and then took up some academic research at Portsmouth University, looking at missing persons and different approaches to missing persons, realised that there was over 4,500 unsolved missing persons cases across the UK. And I'd experienced it myself, where as a detective inspector, you're doing your day job, you're dealing with the dynamic cases that come in every day. But also you're given responsibility for keeping oversight of the unsolved cases and trying to find the resources to apply to those cases in the competing demands of counterterrorism, managing the pandemic response. All of those things take that time away from applying it to the missing persons cases. And then when you speak to the families of missing people, you realise that they sense that gap. They sense that there's something missing. Their case is everything to them. Whilst the police are dealing with a multitude of cases, that case stays with them. And it is that feeling that not everything that's being done could be done on those cases. So for us, the solution was fairly clear. It was about finding a way to help the police service and to collaborate with the police service and provide that support and additional resources and tap into the multitude of skills and experience and enthusiasm that's out there in the universities and finding a way to bring that together to help both the police and the families at no cost to them. There are some great projects in America that we started looking at when we first started the research, where volunteers from universities apply their time to supporting cold cases. But when I started to really dig into the research and research those projects, what was missing was the kind of engine room behind developing the cases to meet the demand. There's so much enthusiasm from students, but you need to find the cases for those students to be able to work on. And there were a lot of really good studies around cold case support provided by universities, but there was one gem of a study that came out with the Mississippi Cold Case Unit, put together by an intelligence specialist, Dr. Carl Jensen, who conducted, he was involved in military intelligence and analysts. And what he did was bring in a team of analysts and intelligence specialists to support the cold case investigation. And all the way through my career, it's that combination of investigation and intelligence that really makes the difference. And that piece of research was hidden away, but they managed to double the clearance rate in the Mississippi cold case unit by applying those skills to it. So at Locate, we do the investigation bit. We've got some really experienced investigators that have spent many, many years investigating cold case. We pair them with investigators from the universities. So people that we train, we mentor and work with those teams. But where we're really going now to support that is the intelligence development. Taking that idea that Carl put together and implemented it, the Mississippi Cold Case Unit, and really beginning to accelerate that by bringing some intelligence expertise and specialists together. And that was one of the reasons for founding Locate, but also tapping into the open source intelligence specialisms that are out there, which led to meeting up with Neil. I worked with Neil many years ago on the police service when we were looking at how you apply open source intelligence to different problems, whether it's the management of sex offenders or domestic violence offenders. There's opportunities to use open source intelligence, and we'd applied new and innovative ways of working in that field. I'm not an open source intelligence specialist, but what I saw was the potential to apply that to missing people cases. So that's where we started working together to try and develop that side of things.
And is Neil doing a good job, Dave?
Neil is doing an excellent job. And I think what it is it's inspiring that next generation of people that didn't think that this was a skill that might apply to them.
Yes.
And Neil will tell you how he got into open source intelligence. He didn't set out as a schoolboy to think, I'm going to be doing open source intelligence, I'm going to become a specialist in that field. But when people see what can be done and how it can be applied, it inspires people to think, yeah, we can do that. And those people are willing to apply their time. So,
yes. So, Neil, how did you get into open source?
Well, when I was a policeman, it was in the 80s and the 90s. And unless you're around in those days, it's hard to imagine now, because we've got smartphones, we've got computers. Everything we do seems to be linked to the internet or seems to be linked to sort of computerization. But in the 80s and the 90s, we didn't have computers in the police. Certainly in Bristol, we didn't have any computers. Or we had one computer in our station, but it was pre-Windows. It was big floppy disks, no mice, long typed in commands. And I actually did a computer course, but only because my writing is so bad, they couldn't read my statement. So I had to type my own reports. And I'd gone on a really old word processor. And that was my only involvement with computers. And when I got pensioned out of the police because I was injured on duty, I just fell into doing surveillance for insurance fraud cases and was following people with video cameras. Just because of meeting a few people, I got a computer so I could send my reports in and my invoices in. Found some people online who said you could find information about people on the internet. And it was really to assist my surveillance. I would start researching people online to see if I could find a photograph of them, because the surveillance would be easier. If I knew where they were working, it would be easier to follow them from home to work, because you knew where they were going to be going. And over the space of 2, 3, 4 years, I went from doing 100% surveillance to doing 100% research on people, just putting a package together, either to prove an insurance fraud or to assist the surveillance company in doing what they were going to be doing, or the surveillance officers. And it carried on developing and developing. So not only was I sort of preparing reports for insurance companies or for surveillance teams, but I was doing a lot of other work. And at that time, engineer, and happened to be talking to him, said what I did for a living. He told me it was called open source intelligence. And he told me, oh, well, actually, we train the National High Tech Crime Unit. But he was running the training courses, but someone had written the course for him. And he didn't actually know anything about what he taught because there were so few open source people about. And he said, well, you actually do what I teach. If you learn how to teach, you can run the course. So really, it developed from there. It was using all of those skills that I thought was just looking for things online and realizing actually it was an intelligence discipline. And over the next sort of few years, it developed and developed. And when I sort of formed my own company, it went from giving a short input to people on intelligence courses. So with the police forces, if they were doing a 3-day intel course, you know, I'd go along, give a talk for an hour, 2 hours. I gave a talk to one force. And because of what I told them about how you could find information about where people lived, so it was all to do with planning applications, someone on the course tried that with a criminal that they were investigating. And as a result, they located some firearms and ammunition. So they were so impressed, they asked me to do a whole course. So it went from a 1 day, 2 day, up to a 5 day course that was recognised by universities that given this training all around the world.
Yeah.
But it's, I come at it from an investigator who's using the computer as a tool rather than a computer person who tries to do an investigation. So, you know, in my police experience, I think of it as when I used to be a response car driver and you were involved in high-speed pursuits and things like that. When you go on your driving course, you're already a police officer, so you know how to arrest people, you know how to write statements, but you need to be taught how to use the police car as a tool. So you're taught how to drive fast and, you know, stop people. So on our training, it's, you know about, you know, writing a statement, you know about presenting evidence at court. So we're just teaching people how to find relevant information for their task. So how the internet works, I don't, you know, sort of who needs to know that? Well, a computer network engineer needs to know that. Mm. When you're on a driving course, you don't need to know how the engine works. You just need to know which is the accelerator, which is the brake. And those, that training that I've given around the world for the last sort of 15, 16 years is what we provide our volunteers with. So they get exactly the same training, but it's swayed or lent towards looking for information on missing people, as opposed to looking for information on fraudsters or looking for information on international criminals. So they get the same level of training, but rather than in a 5 day intensive course, we run virtual online sessions, sort of, you know, hour and a half every week. So this week we trained, well, it was two lots of 28. So I'm going to say with my basic maths, that's about 56 people we had in this week's session.
Yeah.
And we'll work our way through that, all the training materials online for them. And it's quite rewarding. Not comparing myself to Usain Bolt's trainer or anything like that. But you can imagine that the person who trains Usain Bolt obviously gets a lot of... It's very rewarding when Usain Bolt wins a gold medal.
Yeah.
So when we've done a little bit of training... And then someone comes back and says, oh, I found this information online about someone. You sort of, everything's a team effort, really, isn't it? I mean, we might like watching episodes of Inspector Morse or Foyle's War, but investigations aren't really about one lone detective investigating something and finding the murderer, finding the missing person. It's a team effort.
And I think that's the thing, you know, it's important. And there's a diverse background between all of your volunteers, and you obviously have to adapt to that, and you have to, you know, meet their needs in some way. And I guess that comes with training again, where, you know, you might get one volunteer that says, you know, Dave, Neil, I don't understand this way you're teaching. So then do you have another way you explain what you're trying to make them do within your training courses?
Well, it's interesting you say that, because we try to get various experts on sort of once a month, so people have a rest from me doing the training. So we get various people in. And this month, we've got one of our volunteers who's talking about autism and various sort of mental health issues, because that doesn't just affect the people that might go missing, but that will also affect our volunteers, the way we interact with people. And when you are dealing with people who come from around the world, people of different ages, different experiences, you have to tailor what message that you're getting out there. Because if you're talking to a group of 17, 18 year olds in a college environment, I say talking, but obviously virtually, you know that you're talking to a bunch of 18-year-old kids.
Mm.
I say kids in the way an old man talks about anyone who's a lot younger than them. I appreciate they are young adults. But you appreciate you're talking to people of that age group, and you can't talk to them the way that you would talk to a group of 70, 80-year-olds. And likewise, you can't talk to the 70, 80-year-olds as if you're talking to a bunch of sort of 18-year-olds. And likewise, sometimes if you're dealing with people, we've got volunteers in Europe, you have to lose the abbreviations, the colloquialisms of the way that you speak to be able to, you know, get them to understand the message that you're getting across. Mm. And one of the beauties of doing online inquiries is that, you know, we had a one of our volunteers from Greece has done a remarkable piece of work, all based in London.
Yeah, I think we spoke about this the other week when we had a chat. And he, I mean, from Greece, he was finding out some very important vital information, which makes me laugh.
Yes.
And you both are based here.
Yeah, but it's that. It's having volunteers with time.
Yes.
Who can go out there and do the virtual inquiries. And, you know, during our online sessions where we'll talk about a missing person, we tell people what information there is in existence about that missing person, what inquiries have already been made. And we say, sort of, you know, these are potential clues. Where will these clues take us? And we're giving tasks to our volunteers, our teams. And there was one, I can't sort of say too much about it because we're still waiting for a result, which we'll probably sort of mention of one of the frustrations of these things, but we're waiting for a result to come back. But one was, we'd located a photograph of someone who's been reported missing, who possibly is under the control of someone else, shall we say. And we've located a photograph that is very recent. And there wasn't any digital data there, hidden data within photographs called XF data. Mm. There wasn't any XF data. So it's a matter of actually locating that photograph with the clues that were in the image. But there wasn't that many clues. And it was just a case of going online and researching what you could research. And so this one guy from Greece researched who made particular balconies in the London area and what premises they'd supplied them to. And then it was a matter of looking on Google Street View and comparing from different angles, looking at different things before we were able to identify a flat where this person is possibly being held. So, you know, we'd put out the task and a person who is, I don't know how many thousands of miles Greece is from here, but a person not in this country has gone online, virtually used or gone online, done some inquiries, then virtually gone on Google Street View and been able to identify a location for somebody. And that's, you know, police resources have been cut, but even if they hadn't been cut, you wouldn't get a situation where a police officer or staff is told, hey, just spend as much time as you want going online trying to find the location of this image. That is something that really is only going to be achieved with a group of volunteers who can give their time and enthusiasm for free.
You both seen then a change in analytical techniques that you've had to adapt to sort of your training program?
Yeah, I think the I think the policing has always been about community, and certainly in the UK about how you engage with the community, and community intelligence is the heart at the heart of police work. And I think the police service recognise that you can't do everything. So if you're going to tackle a problem, and it's the same as it's always been, you need to find ways to harness the power of the community and engage them in your work. And it's not just about going out and delivering messages about the latest crime rates. It's about creating a pathway for people from the community to engage in the problems of that community. And we've created that pathway in relation to missing persons. It's been done in other ways. But for us, we've created that pathway in relation to missing persons. And I think the power of the work that we're doing is the diversity of the teams that we have. So when we talk about autism, we know that mental health and missing persons, it is related, but actually some of the best investigators that we have are people with autistic traits, because they stay with that problem, and they see things in a concrete way, and they keep pursuing those cases. They may not be a police officer, but what they do bring is a focus on that case. And part of the research that one of our team's doing is, how can we use that more? That is a skill that is worth harnessing and developing. And you don't need to be a police officer to pursue these things. But what we can do is support the police and the community and missing persons from family, from that community. So the community intelligence aspect, we know that neighborhood policing, community policing has shifted because of the capacity to do that. But policing always relied on being able to tap into that intelligence. So our work is about finding ways to reach out to that community. So yes, we work with universities, but our work is now broader than that. So we're reaching out to community groups. So for example, people that have retired recently, they've led a highly skilled life in a previous role, but they now have time to apply to tasks that might help their community. So in the UK, one of the biggest subscribed organisations is Saga, which is for that group of people that are over 50. And when we put what we were doing out in that magazine, we've now had since January the 1st, probably 60 volunteers.
Wow.
People with analytical skills. So they've used analysis in their business. They might not have applied it to policing, but they've used it in banking. They've used it in legal areas, in probate. So they've got research skills. They've got analytical skills. They've got business skills. They've got life skills. And they've got the opportunity to apply that in a positive way. So all we're doing is creating the environment for that to succeed. And that's probably what good teamwork is about. It's about creating the right environment. So we aim to do that by bringing the university students together with other people from the community. So yes, we've got universities at the heart of what we do, and that's where we first started. But our plan was always to find a pathway to engage people from the community and universities are part of the communities. So it's about bringing those two things together.
Mm. And what I think what else you're doing, which is great, is you're prepping the university students who want to have a career within the intelligence field, and you're giving them the skills they need to succeed as an analyst, and they'll bring those new ideas in years to come. And what else it's doing with police services is it's opening their eyes to what an analyst actually is, because there's no set definition. We can't define what an analyst should be, how they should look, how they should act as a computer. So I think, like you're saying, all these different individuals with different backgrounds, in one way, it's going to be successful because bringing all those minds together is a great thing. With police, how do they come into this? Do they provide information, let's say? Do you ever tap into their information databases if there's a gap within the intelligence?
So we have volunteers. Neil volunteers with one of the police forces in the UK, which is Devon and Cornwall Police, and works alongside their missing persons unit with the aim of helping the missing persons investigations, but also problem solving, taking a different perspective on how to look at a case. So we've got that route that we're doing where volunteers are with the police and they're operationally managed from within that police service. But we still mentor those volunteers that are working in that environment. So they stay part of our network, but operationally they're within the police service. But we're about problem solving. We've got people that have solved problems in a multitude of different businesses. So this is about solving a problem. And I remember one of the analysts that worked for me in public protection and the management of sex offenders, a brilliant analyst, now works at PricewaterhouseCoopers. So, and now an analyst there. So people move from industry to public work and backwards. So we try and tap into that. and offer that potential to the police service. So through the work that we're doing, we know the police service recognise they can't take on the sheer volume of missing person cases and do that analytical work. So we can do that problem solving. We can look at how you... So we know from our investigations that we've done, it's about the information collection at the start and how you structure that information collection. So we work with people with analytical skills to develop that information collection from families. We can take that to the next level now, where we can bring that information back to the police and make sure that they've got it available to use whenever they need it. Because they won't have the time to go back over 4,500 cases and check that the information's been collected, and the result will be in the detail within that. But also, how cases come together. What's the relationship between unidentified bodies and missing people and cross-matching? Are there particularly vulnerable groups? So if you look at sex workers, is there more work that can be done around that? And we operate an investigative and an intelligence resource, but primarily problem solving. So we'll look at the problem and try and find a solution to it, whether it's Vietnamese trafficking and people go missing after being identified as being trafficked. So the team late next week are working with a group of people on problem solving around that. So we bring people together to find solutions in and do it in a positive way. Because there are people with the skills.
Yeah. Are there any sort of problems you've encountered on the way, I guess? Well, Neil, you know, the open source, is there anything there that you think this is a problem, and more, I don't know, research around it or networking, talking to other people that do this kind of work needs to be done?
I mean, there are a few issues. One of the things that I'll say might not sort of initially sort of you think it's an issue, but it is for the people who've gone missing and then come back. If you think about any time before the internet, if somebody went missing, which, you know, we're all entitled to walk out and cool off, maybe go away for a week, maybe 2 weeks, maybe a year. You know, if something has happened in your life and you want to leave your family, you know, that is your right. And sometimes people have done that and then they've come back and they start their life again. Well, before we had the internet, the police would put out missing posters. There would be, something on the local news to say someone's gone missing. And once that broadcast had been made, then that's the end of it, because there was no history, you know, there was no way of sort of collecting that history. Now we have the internet. All of those broadcasts are there forever. And imagine you're a 16-year-old child who, for whatever reason, has had a dispute in their life with their family, with a partner, with school. They've gone missing. All of those press releases, all of those campaigns to find that child or an adult are still online. You come back to your family after you've cooled off and you've got your head straight, other issues have been solved. You come back or you start a fresh life. If you go for a job, if you've left school, but you want to go to college, you want to go to university, you want a job, you want a partner. If anyone that searches you, the things that they're going to find out about you are that you went missing and whatever the reason was about why you went missing. And that could be an incredibly personal thing that affects that person for the rest of their lives. And unless you change your name, change your identity, those things are always going to be there. And, you know, whilst, you know, being an online researcher, I love the fact that I can find information about people forever. But some of those personal things actually is harming that person's well-being for years to come. And, you know, we did look at a case of a young lady who had gone missing, and because she was a child at the time, There's obviously a lot of press interest, a lot of online requests to try and find her. But she's not a child anymore. She's an adult who's made her own decisions and is living with her partner, but is now of an age where, you know, she's probably going out to work. She's meeting new people. But if you research her name, you find out about all these, about her backstory, about her personal problems, about her life. Now, that is just an ongoing mental health problem. And it seems, yeah, it's not a criticism of the police or news agencies, but it's just one of those things that these things now go out there. And, you know, you could go on YouTube and watch a whole half hour program about this poor young lady. Now, that's going to follow her forever. And it's one of the unintended consequences of the press releases is that once an organization makes them, you know, they can bombard the internet with all of these press releases. The following week, the person is found. There's no offences. There's no issues. Everything has been sorted, but everything is out there for the rest of their lives. And although we have, you know, the right to be forgotten and you can ask for information to be taken away, you can't delete all of that information. And I think sometimes we should be aware of the responsibility that we have in relation to these people, because it is hanging around there for the rest of their lives, and we've got to consider that. And I say, as an online researcher, I love the fact I can find information, but I must be aware that some of this information is actually harming the very individuals that we want to help.
Yeah,
and I don't think people really consider that.
I think they need to be aware of the effects that could happen if that young individual does return home, and then what happens to? Okay, still have a duty of care for that individual, and we need to consider, you know, different alternatives. And I think sometimes with any investigation, there's not enough consideration with different outcomes in terms of the support after. Yes, you've got family liaison officers, but there are still problems around that, which, you know, are spoken about.
It's just one of those unintended things, and, you know, sort of, you know, thankfully the person has been found alive and they're, you know, they're not in an awful situation, but it's one of those unintended consequences that the effects of that can go on for a lifetime. I mean, there are other issues, but that was the one that came to my mind whilst you were asking the question.
Well, it's a big issue, absolutely. And I think this is probably not an issue only here in the UK, but internationally. And it's something that other forces and other organisations will discuss and, you know, try and come to some kind of sort of agreement in terms of how we approach these sensitive, you know, subjects and cases. I have a question for both of you. Where do you see locate in 5 years' time?
Where we see ourselves in 5 years' time, we've always set out on a project that's sustainable and scalable. So when we started this project, it was always designed to be that, so that it would continue whatever happened because of the structure that we put behind it. So one of the reasons we're starting to work with the universities is you have people that are moving through a system from undergraduate to PhD. And we are finding people stay with the project because they have a passion for the subject and they get value from it. So they'll stay with it from undergraduate to PhD. So that means that we have growth of people that are engaging and are developing new ideas for the future. Our aim is to keep growing that in a sustainable way. So there'll be another 8 universities joining us this year. We don't focus on the number of cases. So one of the biggest problems that we have found is that disproportionate attention to certain missing people cases because of the drive from the media, drive maybe from the family, which I totally understand it's what you want to pursue. There are so many cases that people have never heard of and don't get the right attention. And it's in those gaps that where the intelligence and the analysis can make the difference as to how you look at a group of 4,500 cases with the resources that you have, and you apply analysis to the information that you're collecting. is where you can find the potential. So for us, we don't go on numbers of cases. We have an intelligence team that develop the cases for our investigations, and they keep pursuing those. So as an example, there are about 1,000 unidentified bodies across the United Kingdom, and many of those will be cases where justice is still being sought. They're people that deserve a name. So one example, I think from about 2013, where a person was found in a shallow grave, unidentified until the forensic work was done to build the facial features of the person, to get it out into the media in the right way. And then it was recognised by a family member and somebody was convicted of murder in the end. But there are 1,000 unidentified body cases. So can we make a difference for those? We think we can. So we've taken 22 of those cases that we have allocated to our universities who will apply their time to it over the next 2 years and see if any one of those cases or a percentage of them can be resolved. So starting this month, 22 cases of unidentified people, the universities are applying their time to those cases, working with a range of specialists, working with the police and seeing if by 2022, we can make some sort of progress with those cases. That's just the unidentified cases. So those are just the unidentified people where there's been a body found and we don't know who that person is. It's never been established. So those are those investigations. And we've got cases going back to the 1960s. There's two cases, for example, in the West Midlands. A young nurse who went missing at 17 years old from a hospital in Birmingham. And literally only a distance of 5 miles away, but a gap of over 30 years, another 17-year-old goes missing, both unsolved. Both will have different ways of trying to solve it. In the first one, we're looking at newspaper archives for a post that was put into the contact column of a newspaper, which people used to communicate in those days. So we have to do a different type of research on that case to somebody going missing where there's more potential to make a case. I mean, if you look at no body murders, it's no coincidence that more are solved now because technology leaves a trail. And you can follow those breadcrumbs to where to make the associations between things. The further back you go, the harder it gets. But equally, with time, it's been proved that they can be solved.
Yeah, which is great. And obviously, Neil, your open sources and your training is definitely helping this and encouraging it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we were looking at a case the other night from the mid-1970s. And the team that I was dealing with, I was the only one around during the 1970s. You sort of partially, I must admit, I was obviously just a child during the 1970s, but you explain how things were then. And, you know, people are as enthusiastic because they, you know, that is somebody's, you know, sort of son, daughter, brother, sister, cousin, whatever. People are as enthusiastic about solving those ones as they are about solving the one from a year ago. And in some respects, actually, inquiries are easier now because there are so many databases, so many websites. And when we were looking at this one particular case, there were a couple of questions raised. Well, what's this got a connection to that? And at the time, without the internet, unless you happen to know those areas and you knew those people, you wouldn't have known the connections. But actually going online now, you can find loads of things about an area, about a date that you wouldn't have been able to find at that time because, you know, we're talking about, you know, sort of someone found in one part of the country, but with a connection to another part. And at the time, you wouldn't have known those connections. You wouldn't have known this information existed. So sometimes you know, the passage of time has made things easier. Sometimes it's made things harder. So, you know, we're used now, we've got our smartphones. We probably all, you know, we're taking 10, 15, 20 photographs a day. There's photographs of all of us going back, you know, for the last 20 years. When you're dealing with a case from the 1970s, the 1980s, the 1990s, there is a shortage of photographs of the people that have gone missing because they just don't exist. You know, we used to have rolls of film, negatives. We had to pay to have them processed at the chemists. Then someone's got to keep those photographs. And sometimes, not a criticism of the younger people, but when they say, "Oh, have you got any better photographs? Have you got, you know, why have we only got three photographs of this person?" And you go, "That's because it's from the 1980s. They're just not no photographs." It's almost as if you're talking about a Victorian era, but we just don't have those sort of images.
When the one of the projects that we based our work on was an organisation called NecroSearch, which was a group of people with different specialisms from forensic archaeology to anthropology, came together to solve or to help the police with unsolved cases. And they used to access photographs from tax offices, from all sorts of agencies that would take images that no one was even aware took images, and then use that to help assess and solve the cases. So the material's out there, and Neil and the team that do the open source work tap into these kind of resources. So it's fantastic.
Yeah, it will help. And I think cases that you're looking at now, let's say in 5 years' time, you might solve it then rather now, because technology will always develop. And on that note, I believe you both have a podcast as well.
So we're working with... So what we wanted to do was tell the story of a lot of the cases that don't get attention, but also those unsolved cases. So there's a podcast called The Missing Podcast.org, where I'll be telling at least 20 stories of unsolved cases over the period of the next 20 weeks. So, yeah, you can catch up and listen to that story there, and you can find out how to volunteer with us on our website.
I want to thank you both for joining me today. It's been good fun, and you've provided a lot of useful information.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.